From New York, this is Democracy Now!
It's one thing if it's a minor incursion and then we end up having to fight about what to do and not do, etc. But if they actually do what they're capable of doing with the force amassed on the border, it is going to be a disaster for Russia.
President Biden's predicting Russia will soon invade Ukraine as diplomatic talks continue in Europe. We'll speak to Nation publisher Katrina Vandenhoevel. Her latest piece, Stop the Stumble Toward War with Russia. Plus, we talk to Katrina and Ralph Nader about President Biden's first year in office and the Senate's failure to pass voting rights legislation after Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema sided with Republicans to block changing the filibuster rule. We'll also hear remarks from Senators Raphael Warnock and Bernie Sanders.
Is changing the Senate rules a radical idea? Oh, my God. First time in history we're about to do it. Never been done before. Oh, well, really, not quite.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Democrats have failed in their bid to change Senate rules in order to pass major voting rights legislation. On Wednesday evening, Democrats Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema joined all 50 Republican senators in voting no on a change to the filibuster that would have allowed the voting rights measure to move forward with a simple majority. It was the fifth time this session Republicans have successfully used the filibuster to block voting rights legislation. That capped hours of debate Wednesday that saw some Democrats compare GOP-led voter suppression efforts to racial discrimination under Jim Crow. This is Georgia's Democratic Senator, Reverend Raphael Warnock, one of just three African Americans in the Senate.
History is watching us. Our children are counting on us. And I hope that we will have the courage to do what is right for our communities and for our country. The courage to cross this bridge, to do the hard work in this defining moral moment in America for the sake of the communities that sent us here in the first place, for the sake of the planet, for the sake of health care, for the sake of jobs, for the sake of being able to argue for the things that we care about.
This comes as Republican-led state legislatures have passed more than 30 laws restricting ballot access and have introduced at least 400 more. Mother Jones reporter Ari Berman tweeted, quote, "It's completely undemocratic that 41 GOP senators representing 21% of the U.S. can block bills supported by 70% of public that expand voting access for tens of millions." President Biden capped his first year in office Wednesday with a marathon two-hour news conference in which he blamed Republicans for stalling much of his legislative agenda. It was Biden's first formal news conference since March. Speaking to reporters in the White House, Biden said he expects Russia will invade Ukraine, but predicted that President Vladimir Putin does not want a full-blown war. He said Washington and NATO's response to a Russian invasion will depend on its severity.
Do I think he'll test the West, test the United States and NATO as significantly as he can? Yes, I think he will. But I think he'll pay a serious and dear price for it that he doesn't think now will cost him what it's going to cost him. And I think he'll regret having done it.
We'll have more on Biden and Russia after headlines with Katrina Vandenhoevel, publisher of The Nation magazine. We'll also speak with Ralph Nader about Biden's first year in office and the rest of the news conference yesterday. The Supreme Court's rejected a request by Donald Trump to block the release of some White House records to the Congressional Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. Just hours after the court's 8-1 ruling Wednesday, the National Archives turned over hundreds of pages of documents to the committee. Meanwhile, the January 6th committee has subpoenaed the two leaders of the white nationalist America First, or GROIPER, movement. Nick Fuentes and Patrick Casey helped to coordinate, plan, and fund events that led up to the attack on Congress. Global coronavirus infections have soared to their highest level of the pandemic, fueled by the explosive spread of the Omicron variant. Case counts are at or near record highs in much of South America, including Peru, Brazil, Chile, and Argentina. Much of Europe has broken records for case counts as well, with France, Germany, Austria, and Italy setting new highs for daily infections. In the Czech Republic, the popular folk singer Hana Horkad has died of COVID-19 after she intentionally became infected with the coronavirus. She was a prominent anti-vaccination activist before her death on Sunday. She said she caught the virus in order to enter concert venues requiring either vaccination or proof of recovery from COVID-19. U.S. coronavirus infections are at record highs in many states, but the rapid surge of the Omicron variant appears to be subsiding in several cities, including here in New York, Chicago, and Washington, D.C. More than 3,300 U.S. COVID-19 deaths were reported Wednesday. The vast majority of those who died were unvaccinated. In Texas, Attorney General Ken Paxton has tested positive for COVID and is self-isolating at home. His office would not say whether Paxton has been vaccinated. Paxton is a proponent of the discredited conspiracy theory that Donald Trump won the 2020 election. He previously sued to block President Biden's vaccine mandates. In West Virginia, Republican Governor Jim Justice Wednesday credited vaccinations with possibly saving his life after he became seriously ill with COVID-19 last week.
I would encourage you beyond belief to get vaccinated and whatever you do to get boosted, because I know without anybody telling me in any way, you know, if I hadn't been vaccinated, I'd have been in the hospital for sure, and I'd have been in really tough shape, really, really tough shape.
Florida's health department has placed Orange County's top health official on administrative leave after he encouraged employees to get vaccinated against COVID-19. In an email to employees last week, Dr. Raul Pino lamented the fact that just 38% of Orange County Health Department workers had completed their vaccine series, writing, quote, "I have a hard time understanding how we can be in public health and not practice it," unquote. A state official told the Washington Post the administration of Republican Governor Ron DeSantis was investigating whether Pino's email violated a new Florida law barring government agencies from implementing vaccine mandates. The first flights carrying aid arrived in Tonga today, 5 days after a powerful volcanic eruption blanketed the South Pacific island nation with ash, destroying homes, killing at least three people. Waves as high as 15 meters lashed parts of the archipelago, with tsunami warnings issued as far away as the western United States. The aid flights from New Zealand and Australia were finally able to land after runways were cleared of up to 4 inches of volcanic ash. The supplies come as tens of thousands of people face clean water shortages. Authorities say they are taking extra precautions to prevent COVID-19 from spreading to Tonga's islands as humanitarian workers arrive. Tonga has thus far been spared from the pandemic. As severed communication lines are restored, Tongans have been able to share with the world the devastation of Saturday's eruption and its aftermath. This is local journalist Marion Kupu.
When the first explosion happened, ringing, our ears were ringing, and we couldn't even hear each other. So all we do with mimicry is pointing to our families to get up, to get ready to run, to evacuate. So that's what we did.
In Arizona, a federal judge ruled Wednesday Indigenous activist Amber Ortega was not guilty for her 2020 protest in which she blocked construction on the U.S.-Mexico border near Quitobaquito Springs. Ortega's supporters cheered as they greeted her outside the Tucson courthouse. Ortega, who is from the Hiached and Tohono-O'odham communities, successfully argued the border wall and its construction violated her religious and spiritual beliefs and practices. A warning to our audience, the following two headlines contain descriptions of sexual assault and deadly violence. The University of Michigan's agreed to pay $460 million to over 1,000 survivors of sexual assault at the hands of former university Dr. Robert Anderson. Another $30 million will be set aside for additional survivors who come forward over the next year and a half. Anderson, who died in 2008, was found to have repeatedly assaulted patients over his 37 years at the University of Michigan, including performing unnecessary invasive exams and trading medical services for sexual contact. In Kansas, a district attorney said he will not be filing charges for the killing of black teenager Cedric Lofton while in juvenile prison, citing Kansas's Stand Your Ground law. 17-year-old Cedric Lofton was arrested in September last year and removed from his foster home. After arriving at a juvenile jail, staffers shackled and handcuffed the unarmed teenager while he was face down on the ground. Lofton lost consciousness shortly thereafter and died 2 days later. A medical examiner ruled in December the cause of death was homicide. Andrew Stroth, a lawyer for Lofton's family, said Stand Your Ground laws do not apply in this case, with Lofton posing no threat to the staffers who killed him. Quote, "They basically took Cedric's breath away and killed him," said Stroth. In Arkansas, four prisoners held at the Washington County Jail have filed a lawsuit alleging they were unknowingly prescribed the drug ivermectin as a form of medical experimentation. Ivermectin is an antiparasitic widely used as a horse dewormer. It's been touted in right-wing media as a miracle cure for COVID-19, even though there's no experimental data to back the claim. The ACLU of Arkansas condemned the actions of Washington County Sheriff Tim Helder and a jail physician, writing, quote, "No one, including incarcerated individuals, should be deceived and subject to medical experimentation. Sheriff Helder has a responsibility to provide food, shelter, and safe, appropriate care to incarcerated individuals," unquote. Here in New York, housing activists are demanding passage of a tenants' rights bill that would require landlords to provide good cause for evictions. The good cause eviction bill would bar landlords from removing a renter without a court order and would give tenants the right to renew a lease in most cases. It would also cap rent increases for existing tenants. About 100 lawmakers have co-sponsored the bill, which is stalled in Albany, pending the support of New York Governor Kathy Hochul and other Democratic leaders. This comes as New York officials allowed a moratorium on evictions to expire Saturday, even as daily COVID infections reached their highest level of the pandemic. On Friday, police arrested at least 16 protesters who blocked a busy intersection near Governor Hochul's Manhattan office.
I am prepared to do whatever it takes to help protect my neighbors who are at most at risk of being homeless because the governor won't act to provide stronger tenant protections to tenants.
People are dying and Governor Kathy Hochul is doing nothing about it. And until she does something, we will not stop.
And workers have started removing the statue of President Theodore Roosevelt from the steps of the American Museum of Natural History in New York. The city's Public Design Commission voted last June to take down the monument amidst nationwide protests and a reckoning with the racist legacy of the U.S. The statue depicts Roosevelt on a horse with a Native American man and an African American man standing beside him. In a statement, the Natural History Museum said, quote, "The statue itself communicates a racial hierarchy the museum and members of the public have long found disturbing," unquote. The statue will go on long-term loan to North Dakota's Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library, despite the objections of some indigenous groups in North Dakota. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, President Biden's predicting Russia will soon invade Ukraine as diplomatic talks continue in Europe. We'll speak with the nation's publisher, Katrina Vandenhoevel, whose latest piece is headlined, "Stop the Stumble Toward War with Russia." Then Ralph Nader will join us as well to talk about the year's news conference that President Biden held yesterday. Stay with us.
Mistaken for a vision. Something of my own creation. I wake up alone. with only daylight between us. Last night the world was beneath us. Tonight comes too long. Were we torn apart by the break of day? You're more than I can believe. Whatever come my way.
By the XX. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world.
Well, President Biden said Wednesday he expects Russia will invade Ukraine, but predicted Russian President Vladimir Putin does not want a full-blown war. Russia's reportedly stationed about 100,000 troops on its Ukraine border and sent troops into Belarus, which also shares a border with Ukraine. Biden said Washington's response to a Russian invasion will depend on its severity.
Russia will be held accountable if it invades, and it depends on what it does. It's one thing if it's a minor incursion and then we end up having to fight about what to do and not do, et cetera. But if they actually do what they're capable of doing with the force amassed on the border, it is going to be a disaster for Russia.
Biden's remarks about a minor incursion alarmed officials in Ukraine. Shortly after the news conference ended, Biden's press secretary, Jen Psaki, released a statement clarifying Biden's comments about a minor incursion by saying, quote, if any Russian military forces move across the Ukrainian border, that's a renewed invasion and it will be met with a swift, severe and united response from the United States and our allies. During the news conference, President Biden also predicted Russian President Vladimir Putin will move troops into Ukraine. This is Biden responding to a question from David Sanger of The New York Times about Putin.
I think he still does not want any full-blown war, number one. Number two, do I think he'll test the West, test the United States and NATO as significantly as he can? Yes, I think he will. But I think he'll pay a serious and dear price for it that he doesn't think now will cost him what it's going to cost him. And I think he'll regret having done it. I'm not so sure he has is certain what he's going to do. My guess is he will move in. He has to do something. And by the way, I've indicated to him the two things he said to me that he wants guarantees on. One is Ukraine will never be part of NATO. And two, that NATO or there will not be strategic weapons stationed in Ukraine. Well, we can work out something on the second piece, pretending what he does along the Russian line as well, the Russian border in the European area of Russia.
Sounds like you are offering some way out here, some off-ramp, and it sounds like what it is at least an informal assurance that NATO is not going to take in Ukraine anytime in the next few decades. And it sounds like you're saying we would never put nuclear weapons there. He also wants us to move all of our nuclear weapons out of Europe and not have troops rotating through the old Soviet bloc. Do you think there's space for that there?
No. No, there's not space for that. We won't permanently station, but the idea we're going to actually increase troop presence in Poland or Romania, et cetera, if in fact he moves, because we have a sacred obligation in Article 5 to defend those countries. They are part of NATO. We don't have that obligation relative to Ukraine, although we have great concern about what happens in Ukraine.
That's President Biden speaking at his two-hour news conference Wednesday. Secretary of State Tony Blinken's planning to meet with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov Friday. Blinken's meeting with some of his NATO counterparts in Berlin today and was in Kiev Wednesday. To talk about U.S.-Russian relations, we're joined by Katrina VandenHeuvel, editorial director and publisher of The Nation magazine. She's been reporting from Russia and on Russia for the last 30 years. She's also a columnist for The Washington Post. Her latest piece is headlined, Stop the Stumble Toward War with Russia. In your piece, you write, in the technical argo of diplomacy, what's going on in the Ukraine crisis is nuts. Katrina, can you first respond to what President Biden said, what the White House took back after, and actually what is going on?
Well, I mean, Amy, first of all, what you just listened to, David Sanger of The New York Times, who's been on the beat to promote conflict or war with Russia for Ukraine for several years. What's going on is that the most immediate task is to defuse the immediate crisis. And you can hear in Biden's, the interstitial pieces of Biden, if you decipher what he said, that there is room, if there was creative diplomacy, if there was as much time spent pondering what Putin's going to do or worrying about the, you know, not even worrying, but ginning up war. What's clear is that three presidents, Obama, Trump, and even Biden, have said that Ukraine is not a national security, vital security interest of the United States. No president at this moment is going to send men and women to Ukraine to fight. It has become a proxy war, however. It's been geopoliticized when, in fact, it's a civil war. And there is this relationship between Russia and Ukraine, and also goes back to the bigger issue, Amy, of NATO expansion. In, you know, 1997, there was a vigorous debate in this country about NATO expansion, and key people who knew Russia well warned it would lead to a new Cold War. So here we are, and I think, we're living at a time, Amy, of pandemic, of racial division, of staggering economic inequality, of climate crisis. And to go to war or even to contemplate these two new Cold Wars, Russia and China, seems to me nuts. And more attention should be paid to how we can exit these conflicts, how we can find a way for an independent Ukraine, free and whole, between East and West, as opposed to all this talk about more military massing on the border, or even, and I'll end here, the New York Times the other day planting anonymous intelligence sources warning of a false flag operation, which would create a pretext for Russian invasion. There is that danger. Why I use the word stumble is that it, you know, looks a little like World War One, where some accident could happen. You got two nuclear armed countries. And I think instead of focusing on troops and this, let's find a diplomatic, tough diplomatic solution. And let's begin the arms control work that needs to be done. The INF could be brought back. It was abolished by John Bolton and Trump, 2019. Today's a doomsday clock announcement. Will it be closer to midnight, which is perilous? Lots of work to be done instead of all this talk about war, 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 troops, troops, troops.
Well, Katrina, we'll go back in a second to, as you said, possible diplomatic resolution to the conflict, you know, Blinken's meetings in the last couple of days and tomorrow meeting with Lavrov. But you mentioned, and this is a critical issue, the question of NATO expansion since 1997. I mean, it's staggering. There have been a very large number of countries that have joined. Since 1997, Eastern European countries, Poland, Hungary, the Czech Republic, Bulgaria, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Romania, Slovakia, Slovenia, Albania, Croatia, Montenegro, and most recently, North Macedonia. So two questions. First of all, could you explain why Russia is especially concerned about Ukraine joining a NATO, and also what the significance, the importance of what the function is of NATO now that the, I mean, it's been decades now that the Warsaw Pact was dissolved.
That is the central question, Shermina. I mean, when the Warsaw Pact was dissolved, naturally one would think NATO would be dissolved, and we would find a new security architecture that wasn't a militarized one. By the way, in 1997, people like Paul Nitzer, Richard Pipes, McNamara, these people opposed the expansion. But put that aside, the expansion of NATO was the expansion of a military institution, which is dominated by the United States. This is no coffee klatch. This is a group which brings weapons to the fore. You have to buy certain weapons, you know, get in sync with the whole operation. There are other institutions that could have created, as Mikhail Gorbachev had spoken of, a common European home from Vladivostok to Lisbon, which wouldn't have been militarized. You know, Russia, the Soviet Union, lost 27 million people in World War II. There is a real continuing fear in even in younger generations about being encircled. And, you know, we had our Monroe Doctrine. We had our spheres of influence. What if Mexico, what if Soviet troops had Russian troops suddenly decided to alight in Mexico? Borders matter, especially in the Russian historical consciousness. But it's that is playing a role right now. Ukraine, unlike the other countries you mentioned, has had a very special relationship with Russia, and Russia with Ukraine. Ukraine is a divided country. It is a country that has a right to be fully independent, but it is very much a lot of Russians are intermarried with Ukraine. Ukraine is not like Montenegro. And so I think one has to understand that there is an expression in foreign affairs called strategic empathy. I mean, you try, and if there was standing in the other's shoes, not condoning, but understanding, I think we would be in a better place. Finally, Article 5 of NATO demands that NATO members go to the military assistance of countries which are invaded. I come back to the fact that, first of all, no American president, in my understanding, will send American men and women to fight. There is talk of funding an insurgency in Ukraine. How did that turn out in Afghanistan when we funded the Mujahideen? So there are a lot of issues, but, you know, Gorbachev was promised after German reunification that NATO would not move one inch eastward. That is to be found in archives, National Security Archive, for example. And there's kind of a thought that Putin is asking for written material because he thinks that might protect him from Gorbachev's fate. I don't think so. But again, I come back to, if there is creative diplomacy, I think you could see a resolution of this crisis. And, you know, to have war at this time is to add to the other wars we confront, climate, pandemics.
And as far as the negotiations are concerned, Katrina, can you talk about what we know so far about what happened in the meetings between Zelensky and Blinken and today his meetings with his counterparts in the EU, and what to expect from what might happen tomorrow with Blinken's meeting with Lavrov. Yesterday, also on Wednesday, French President Macron, going against what the U.S. has called for, has urged EU states to speak directly to Russia. Could you comment on that as well?
That, I think, is very important, and it speaks to a diplomatic resolution that may be able to be revived, either called Minsk, the Minsk Agreement, or the Normandy Agreement, which was originally Germany, France, Russia, Ukraine, not the United States. But I think it's a good sign that European countries may have more independence, France, Germany, in working out something with Russia. And I think, you know, what is happening in Ukraine, I don't know, except that Zelensky's rival arrived in Ukraine, Kiev, the other day, the chocolate king, who was the previous president, and was arrested and is sitting in a, you know, courthouse. What that is, why that's happening now, maybe it exposes some of the real problems in Ukraine. By the way, Ukraine couldn't legally enter NATO right now because its territorial integrity is not whole. I think Lavrov, and I'll, you know, get in trouble for this, is one of the most steady and experienced diplomats working today. So I think if Blinken and Lavrov could get beyond some of the kind of rhetoric, you could see some real dealings that would be resolution, perhaps moving back to Minsk, and or finding EU as a vehicle, or finding the OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. So I think this is hopeful that there are ongoing meetings, because I do think the crisis immediately, the importance of that being diffused, then gives some space.
And Katrina, before we turn to other aspects of Biden's comments yesterday and assessment of his first year in office, one last point on what's happening now in Ukraine. I mean, the U.S. and EU have discussed the possibility of wide-ranging sanctions against Russia as a first step. I mean, there are already sanctions in place. Could you say something about the kinds of sanctions that are being contemplated and the significance of the U.S. possibly cutting Russia off from the dollar-denominated international financial system? What would that mean, and how likely is it?
Well, I think you're certainly hearing a lot of talk about punitive sanctions, you know, onerous sanctions. First of all, one needs to understand there are already layers and layers of sanctions on Russia. In fact, the Democrats put forward their sanction bill the other day, and I believe it was Cruz put forward one. I do think the swift removing Russia from the global trading system could have real implications. But, you know, that could push Russia closer to China and an alternative currency, which would not be helpful to the Europeans or to the United States. And I think the again, in Germany, you have the big issue of Nord Stream, the pipeline. It's an interesting moment because that is not yet fully approved. There's still some regulatory issues. You now have a new government in Germany. The foreign minister is a Green, and the Greens are opposed to the pipeline for environmental and other reasons. So that may be played out apart from sanctions imposed by the United States. In general, sanctions have not worked. They have made countries more resistant to U.S. pressure. And I think the whole matter of sanction as a foreign policy, in some cases, it's the equivalent of war. The humanitarian cost has to be thought through.
We're going to leave it there for now and, of course, continue to cover this issue. Katrina VandenHeuvel, editorial director and publisher of The Nation magazine, columnist for The Washington Post, will link to your pieces there. The latest one, Stop the Stumble Toward War with Russia. Katrina is going to stay with us as we look at President Biden's first year in office and the Senate's failure to pass voting rights legislation after Manchin and Sinema sided with the Republicans to block changing the filibuster. And we will be joined as well by Ralph Nader. Stay with us.
Yesterdays, days I knew as happy. Sequestered days, olden days, golden days, days of mad romance.
Yesterdays by Carmen McRae. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. As President Biden marked 1 year in office with a rare marathon news conference at the White House Wednesday, his former colleagues in the Senate spent hours debating a proposed change to the filibuster that would allow the voting rights measure to move forward with a simple majority. But for the fifth time this session, Republicans filibustered voting rights again. Right-wing Democratic Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema joined with Republicans to defeat the change. Manchin delivered his Senate floor speech while Biden held his news conference, the Dueling Joes. After the vote, Senate Republicans gathered in the chamber to shake Senator Sinema's hand. Progressive Democratic Senator Bernie Sanders said Tuesday he would support primary challengers to Manchin and Sinema. Senator Sanders spoke on the Senate floor Wednesday.
Is changing the Senate rules a radical idea? Oh, my God. First time in history we're about to do it. Never been done before. Oh, well, really, not quite. No. As every member of the Senate knows, the rules get changed on a fairly regular basis. Nothing radical about it. Just a few months ago, in order to raise the debt ceiling and prevent our government from defaulting on its loans, the rules were changed so that a 50-vote majority would prevail. We changed the rules appropriately, and we prevented a default and a massive worldwide depression. Just a few years ago, my Republican colleagues who were so adamantly against changing rules, well, my goodness, they changed the Senate rules to allow 50 votes to confirm the president's nominees to the Supreme Court. Oh, my goodness, how shocking. And they got three conservative Supreme Court justices as a result. Rules get changed around here all of the time. And maybe, just maybe, we might want to change the rules in order to save American democracy.
Democratic Senator Bernie Sanders speaking Wednesday during the debate to change filibuster rules in order to pass key voting rights legislation. Some Democrats compared GOP-led voter suppression efforts to racial discrimination under Jim Crow. This is Georgia Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock, one of the three African Americans in the Senate. His speech closed out the pleas from Democrats.
Those of us who are students of Dr. King, I know I have often wondered, what would I have done if I were alive during the Civil Rights Movement? I know we would all like to think that we too would have had just a small fraction, just a fraction of the courage that it took for John Lewis to cross that Edmund Pettus Bridge. Well, for those of us who are fortunate enough to serve in the United States Senate in this moment, in this moral moment, we do not have to wonder. My God, he faced troopers on the other side crossing that bridge. We're talking about a procedural bridge. We don't have to wonder what we would have done. I submit that what we would have done back then, we are doing right now. History is watching us. Our children are counting on us. And I hope that we will have the courage to do what is right for our communities and for our country. The courage to cross this bridge, to do the hard work in this defining moral moment in America for the sake of the communities that sent us here in the first place, for the sake of the planet, for the sake of healthcare, for the sake of jobs, for the sake of being able to argue for the things that we care about. The courage to fight for one another. I'm still praying that we will cross that bridge. But if not tonight, we will come back again and again and again.
That's Georgia Democratic Senator the Reverend Raphael Warnock speaking on the Senate floor Wednesday during a debate that unfolded as President Biden held a two-hour news conference marking his first year in office. We spend the rest of the hour looking at Biden's agenda so far after he entered office reeling from the violent January 6th insurrection in the middle of a deadly pandemic, is now facing a new surge in COVID-19, among other challenges. We're joined by two guests, Ralph Nader, longtime consumer advocate, corporate critic, four-time presidential candidate. He's the author of many books, including Breaking Through Power, It's Easier Than We Think. And continuing with us, Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor editorial director and publisher of The Nation magazine, columnist for The Washington Post. Ralph Nader, let's begin with you. If you can respond to what we just heard, to say the least, you're a critic of how Democrats and Republicans deal with elections in this country and what happened yesterday, and then move on to overall the what President Biden said yesterday.
Well, the two-hour news conference was deliberate. I think he wanted to show his stamina, and he had a great opportunity to communicate a lot of important things, which he didn't do. By the same token, the media did not make itself proud. It had a very narrow range of questions, and huge areas were never asked. They're never asked about climate disruption and the Republican opposition to doing anything about it. They didn't ask about the military budget, where Congress gave Biden $24 billion, more than the Pentagon even asked for. They didn't ask about the drain on the Treasury from hundreds of billions of dollars of corporate welfare, which is a kind of corporate socialism. They didn't ask about the corporate crime wave that is ripping off consumers and exploiting labor in this country and has been reported around the country. And he didn't raise those questions either. They raised the antitrust issue. He raised it properly for meatpacking companies controlling and the pricing of meat products. But no one asked him, well, if he's so keen on antitrust and anti-monopoly policy, why isn't he demanding larger budgets? There are very few federal antitrust cops on the corporate monopoly, be it the Federal Trade Commission or the Department of Justice. Most interestingly, the press didn't ask about what his attorney general is going to do to prosecute Donald Trump. We've written letters to Merrick Garland listing one criminal federal statute after another that he openly and brazenly violated, including political events on the White House lawn, which is a crime under the Hatch Act. No answer whatsoever. No special counsel being appointed to investigate and recommend prosecution of this criminal recidivist, Donald J. Trump, who has never seen a law that he hasn't violated. So if you look at the big picture, it was a very disappointing press conference from both sides. The issues that Biden didn't raise and the dittohead type narrow range of questions from the media.
Ralph, one of the issues that Biden did address was, of course, the pandemic. If you could respond to the comments he did make on the pandemic and the fact that, you know, what's happened since last May, the Biden administration supported a waiver of the COVID-19 vaccines and Public Citizen that has come out with a study showing that within a year, 8 billion doses of an mRNA vaccine could be produced for $23 billion. I mean, what more could the Biden administration be doing?
Well, they could be leading an international consortium to spend that modest amount for vaccination throughout the third world. They could be playing much tougher against the drug companies that are being subsidized to levels of profiteering, Pfizer, Moderna, and exerting their patent monopoly rights and blocking wider manufacturing of these medicines. They haven't done that.
Let's talk about that, Ralph. I want to talk specifically about this. I mean, Public Citizen is one of the groups that you founded that put out that report. And interestingly, doesn't call the Moderna vaccine the Moderna vaccine. They call it the NIH Moderna vaccine, like you talk about Pfizer-BioNTech, because NIH, that is the people's health institute of this country, taxpayer funded, had their scientists working on this as well, provided enormous amount of resources. So if you can talk specifically, while President Biden was asked, about providing the vaccines to the world, what he specifically could demand, for example, of Moderna, who got the money at the front end, and Pfizer, that was promised the money at the back end, in terms of sharing the recipe, the formula, with factories and manufacturers around the world that are used to producing drugs but just simply don't have those recipes.
Well, the federal government has long had the authority to break these patents in times of emergency, which is clearly the case. He's not doing it. The World Health Organization has authority to do it as well. And as Public Citizen reported, we're talking about $35 billion, which is only a third of Apple Corporation's stock buyback last year, $90 billion. So there wouldn't be a vaccine without the National Institutes of Health research over the last 25 years. All the basic research is funded by the taxpayer, and the taxpayer doesn't get much of a return. The taxpayer is basically funding corporate patent monopolies over these drugs, and not just the vaccines here, but a whole range of drugs. The taxpayer is funding all kinds of drug research and development so that the drug companies can export their manufacturing of drugs to China and India. We have a national security problem here. There are no antibiotics manufactured in the U.S. There's no penicillin manufactured in the U.S. It's imported from China and India under very inadequate Food and Drug Administration inspection. He made a big deal saying he's not a socialist like Bernie Sanders. He is a corporate socialist completely. He has always in his career, Joe Biden, supported subsidies, handouts, giveaways, bailouts without any challenge. And he's continuing to do that. And the reporters didn't take him to task there. The reporters, either they're not doing their homework or they're full of taboos. I mean, they never raise the corporate supremacy over our country. There isn't a single agency in the federal government that isn't influenced maximally by corporate lobbies. And Congress is sworn by corporate lobbies. You have 500 drug company lobbyists full-time assigned to Congress. And there are 535 members of Congress. And these corporations are strategically commercializing every aspect of our society, commercializing childhood, strategically planning the tax system, the food system, the health system, fighting global warming remedies, the fossil fuel industry, Exxon Mobil. They're planning our genetic inheritance. Commercializing childhood should be a left-right issue, conservative issue. The press never asks about it. The self-censorship of the press is overwhelming. That's why we have to have a more independent media. We have to. I mean, look at the coverage of Ukraine. As Katrina pointed out, if our country was invaded in a span of 40 years from the north, with 50 million casualties, what do you think we would do? You think we would just station troops on the northern border? We would have taken over the northern country and annexed it. And that's why dictator Putin can get away with what he's doing now in terms of public opinion of the impoverished Russian people, is because they remember they have their casualties in their families from the Western frontier, started with Napoleon. And here we are expanding a military alliance for arms sales for the military-industrial complex, because, as was pointed out, a condition of joining NATO's to buy the F-16 and other weapons in Eastern European countries. NATO is a military alliance organized against the Soviet Union. And now they're expanding it in Eastern Europe and putting troops there. It's here we go again, a completely preventable conflict. What Putin really wants is Ukraine never to join NATO. No strategic offensive weapons in Ukraine. He's asking for ending strategic weapons in Europe, that is not going to happen. But the press asks war-inciting questions. NPR asks it. David Sanger asks it. They ask war-inciting questions. It's like Vietnam all over again. It's like Iraq all over again. They don't ask peace-inciting questions about diplomacy. This is a dangerous situation, and the press just isn't doing its job. It isn't just Biden. He can't communicate how the GOP is opposed to everything that's defined as human. You don't make moral appeals to the GOP like Senator Warnock just did. You show that they're opposed to sending $250 and $300 monthly checks to 65 million children, which has stopped now, and the GOP will not expand it. I mean, that's a good political item to communicate to the American people. Those 65 million children come from conservative and liberal families who are both deprived. He doesn't know how to communicate. The GOP knows what it wants. It's messianic. It's fascistic. It's driven. And the communication from the Democrats, from the DNC to the White House is weak. It's anemic. And the public senses that.
Well,
he doesn't know how to sell his own program.
I want to go to President Biden speaking about the Build Back Better Act and both get Ralph Nader's response and overall Katrina Vandenhoevel's response as well.
Yes, I'm confident we can get pieces, big chunks of the Build Back Better law signed into law. I think that we can get, and I've been talking to a number of my colleagues on the Hill, I think it's clear that we would be able to get support for the $500+ billion for energy and the environmental issues that are there, number one. Number two, I know that the two people who've opposed, on the Democratic side at least, support a number of the things that are in there. For example, Joe Manchin strongly supports early education, 3 and 4 years of age, strongly supports that. There is strong support for, I think, a number of the way in which to pay for these, pay for this proposal. So I think there is, I'm not going to negotiate against myself as to what should and shouldn't be in it, but I think we can break the package up, get as much as we can now, and come back and fight for the rest later.
So breaking up Build Back Better. Katrina, if you could start by responding both to Build Back Better and overall the rest of the news conference that President Biden held yesterday on this first anniversary of his inauguration.
On the Build Back Better front, first of all, let's not forget the American Rescue Plan, which $1.9 trillion, it helped cut poverty, child poverty, and if the child tax credits continued, you could continue 40% reduction in poverty for a long, long time. Bernie Sanders thought that was the most consequential legislation for working people in decades. You had the bipartisan infrastructure plan, but it's this Build Back Better, of course, that is in play. There is a move on to come back next week in the progressive side of Congress and put back a plan that was laid out in November. I hate to do the numbers because I think the media did a great disservice by sort of cutting the numbers every day instead of laying out what was in the plan, or maybe saying 1% of GDP instead of, in one New York Times story, tax and spend, huge piece of legislation. But I think they're going to come back with climate, childcare, and tax stuff and find a way to move that forward and connect it to the social, racial, economic justice of a voting rights bill and what we've seen this past week. So that seems to me this next week is going to really be a push on trying to put back, build back together, build back better, and not in the way the moderates in the Congress look at it, the House moderates, not piece by piece, but a more transformative bill, not the $6.4 trillion, to use a number. In terms of picking up on what Ralph said, I do think Biden, you know, a long press conference, rambling press conference, doesn't make up for maybe speaking to the people every month. I wrote a column of, you know, a year ago about fireside chats. Maybe that's maudlin. Maybe that's not his form. But the messaging, connecting to people, speaking to people, not only speaking, but laying out who the villains are, laying out some of what Ralph said in a maybe more homespun way. But it's surprising that he has failed in that way. Not necessarily, you know, he could have, I think, done better. Of course, he's not a socialist, but the need to say that is always part of the trope. And I do think Ralph is absolutely right. In the media, you get the media who's in that room, the media in that room, that press room, is, for example, asking more inciting questions. The questions are leading to the answers they want. And you don't get, it's kind of a suffocating consensus of questions in that room. And I remember Helen Thomas on the eve of Iraq, who was kind of mocked by her colleagues because she was asking tough questions of President Bush, who was ready for airballs. And that's really, I think, very sad. And what's not on the agenda are the kinds of questions Ralph asked. Maybe not as tough as Ralph would ask them, but framed in a way that would really produce some news that's needed, necessary news for the American people. One last thing on the mandate, the mask. What the Supreme Court, the decision that's not been reported sufficiently in my mind about test, vaccinate and test, I mean, that is shocking that the Supreme Court, it's not shocking in the same way President Biden should not be shocked by the Republican Party as it exists today, but that the Supreme Court essentially sided with death, I think, in that COVID decision is something we should think long and hard about.
And very quickly, Ralph Nader responding to Build Back Better being broken up.
There are two major omissions here. He didn't push his tax increases for corporations and the corporate rich, super rich, which he proposed, because these programs are not supposed to be on the backs of our descendants in terms of deficits. They should be paid for by restoring the tax system to the level of the prosperous 60s when the corporations paid much higher taxes. And he didn't take advantage there. And he didn't take advantage of, he calls himself a union guy. He should have pushed for the $15 minimum wage through the Senate. He should have showed how the Republicans are against almost everything that he's proposing that has huge popular polls, left-right support from the social safety net to build rebuilding America and community after community with the support of the local chamber of commerce and local unions. He missed that, and he didn't push the bill that his own Democrats passed in the House, languishing in the Senate, to make it easier for workers to form unions. And most critically, these programs are going to fail if they don't deal with audits and anti-corruption efforts inside. The Inspector General for the Small Business Administration has been pointing out for years that the big companies are ripping off the payroll protection plan. They don't deserve it. Some corporate law firms actually got money from the corporate protection plan, which is designed mostly for small business. So if the press doesn't want to ask these very fundamental questions, that doesn't mean that Biden's advisors shouldn't have emphasized in his original message at the press conference to highlight these areas.
Katrina, we have just a minute left. His press conference took place at a time when his approval ratings in his first year are extremely, substantially lower than when he began. What are the likely consequences of this for the midterms later this year?
Not pretty, but he has time to turn it around. A day, you know, a week in politics is, you know, a whole other time factor. But he needs to do some things that are, you know, both morally and strategically important. Student loan debt, some of those issues, use executive actions in ways not to, to speak to a base that is demoralized, but could be put back together. A lot of work ahead, but I think it's possible.
We're going to leave it there. But we thank you both so much for being with us. Katrina VandenHeuvel, editorial director and publisher of The Nation magazine, columnist for The Washington Post, will link to her pieces and to The Nation. And Ralph Nader, four-time presidential candidate, consumer advocate extraordinaire. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a human resources manager. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Be safe. Wear a mask.